Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with David Benedetto of WRBH Radio, host of the Writers Forum and Figures of Speech, and photographer J.T. Blatty, whose beautiful new book is Fishtown. David Benedetto is the Assistant Program Director and Marketing Director at WRBH Radio for the Blind and Print Impaired. He hosts the Writers Forum programs as well as Figure of Speech, where writers share their work. So we thought we'd get together and exchange interviews and look back on the year just passed. David Benedetto, it is so great to have you here.
Susan, it is my honor to be here.
We like to speak each other's language.
We do, literally, you know. I'm so happy to be speaking with you.
So tell me, you're a longtime radio guy, dating back to your days at LSU, at KLSU there. And so what was it like to make a transition from a radio station like that to a mission-driven station like WRBH?
It was not as difficult as you would think. I think one of the harder aspects of it was being in the college radio station, having more control and having that music focus and that being everything, to moving to a more mission-driven organization, to where you are constantly thinking not about the listener and the songs and the modern tastes, but how are our listeners going to approach these materials that we're putting on air, and how do we make sure to put the most up-to-date portions of those things on the air.
And you have that great, great challenge of choosing what gets read on the air. So that's a huge job. I think that would be very difficult. So what are some of the things you're looking for in a book you choose to read on WRBH?
That's a very good question. So half of the program is my responsibility, which is the literary version of that. Tim Vogel, our program director, takes care of most of the magazines and the news-oriented things. Mm-hmm. When I'm looking for books, I'm looking for things that represent our culture and things that I think the New Orleans community at large will be interested in. And those are various different things that everybody's going to have a different opinion on. So I try and monitor different feeds online, publications, see what people are talking about in the year previous, as well as what writer friends in the community at large are kind of looking at, in the literary community here, looking at and really talking about and trying to bring that to the forefront.
Have you ever made a really risky choice?
Sometimes. I think books explicitly dealing with race and identity, you never know how people are going to react. I remember we had discussions about putting Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, on air.
Great
and wondering
book.
How, a very, very good book, but obviously it nails a lot of things that make people uncomfortable in certain situations. And we really wanted to make sure that that was out there, that people were able to hear that in a timely manner.
So how do you get feedback from your listeners?
We take phone calls and emails, as well as just kind of, you know, it's one of those things to where if we're not receiving any complaints, we're kind of feeling like full speed ahead, we'll take it. And most of the time, people are really constructive in their criticism. We very rarely ever get a non-constructive telephone message or email.
Oh, that's nice.
It's good, right? We like it.
But the great thing for me about WRBH is that even if you're not vision impaired or print impaired in any way, you still enjoy being read to. Every now and then, I'll be driving along in my car and I'll hit on WRBH, and then I'll get stuck. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I love that. That's one of my favorite aspects of the job, is to come in on a Tuesday morning and have an email from someone at 2:30 a.m., a truck driver or someone, saying, I heard this mystery book on at 1 a.m. and I had to stay in my car after my shift to finish it. What is the name of that book? And being like, okay, this is a score one for us. This is great.
Right.
And you're very much right. Obviously, we're founded and our mission is to provide the written word in a spoken format for people that don't have easy access to it otherwise. But I do think people in the New Orleans community that are not sight impaired, that are not blind, can enjoy listening to a random segment or a book or the latest edition of People magazine and come away just as fulfilled as somebody that relies on that.
Now, one of the wonderful things about WRBH is that, you know, we live in the age of audiobooks, and you think, well, there are audiobooks everywhere, but you're bringing in people to read to us. It's kind of magical that you're not just playing an audiobook that's out there in a bookstore. So talk a little bit about the readers themselves and what they like and what kinds of people they are.
They are my absolute favorite aspect of the job, and they are the reason that we're able to exist. We have over 150 of them that come in on a week-by-week basis and read everything from the grocery ads to Les Miserables, right?
Right.
This huge in-between, and you get such a mix of folks, whether it be a lawyer from uptown or this 87-year-old that grew up in the Ninth Ward, right? And you get to see this complete spread of personalities that really make up the city and really have their own set of taste and things that they're good at. And so that's one of the things we try and practice is with each individual volunteers trying, relying, and if we can, trying to see what fit they will best take. I have certain voices that are more suited towards nonfiction, more straight ahead reads, while I have more actor-like or vocal quality performances. I have a guy right now who does improv and acting, and he's reading Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, and he's going into all the voices. He has it mapped out. It's so fun to have him come out like every 5 minutes and be like, okay, do you think this voice is okay? Is this going over the top? And to kind of play with that. And it's really enjoyable on my part to kind of foster that relationship with our volunteers.
And people follow certain readers as well. You know, they have fans.
They do. We get letters from time to time. We had one longtime listener. We haven't heard from her recently, but she'd always call and be like, hey, I hear a new reader who's reading that book right there. What's his name? And then, you know, about a week later, we'd get a fan letter. And so it'd be like, well, you're on the list now. So whenever you read a book, you're definitely getting one of these.
And sometimes authors read their own books, don't they?
They do. We were lucky to have Clayton Delery read one of his books just this past year. And we recently recorded Sybil Morial's memoir for a publication that released it that they're going to be presenting, I think, fairly soon.
Oh, that's fantastic. That must be fun.
It's good.
To see them do it.
It's great. It's one of those things, after the writer's forum, I can make the contact with the author. And if they've got the time, if they live in town, just being able to present their own work in that way. And it's really fun for them, I think, honestly, because they wrote this thing. And if it's a local author, sometimes they won't get a chance to perform it outside of a reading. So here they can have it in an archive form.
And the whole book.
The entire thing. Yes.
So who are some of your favorites from the last year? What are some of the favorite books you've covered or authors you've met?
One that comes to mind most recently, she's not a local author, but she came into town to present a forum and a reading at the Bywater Institute, Elizabeth Rush, who wrote a book called Rising.
Right.
I believe you talked with her as well. I really loved that book and her really thoughtful and eloquent ways of describing climate change and things that are happening on the coast. And I had a really excellent discussion with her that's going to air sometime soon, I hope.
And that's our most pressing issue.
It is, being right here, and it's something you can't avoid. And she wrote it in such a way that's very lyrical and poetic and in this mourning sense that really humanizes people and provides these through lines that are deeply affecting. And I think about that one a lot.
Mm-hmm. What about fiction? Can you think of some of your favorite fiction from this year?
Yes, actually, I have a list.
Man after my own heart. I have my list here.
I spent most of yesterday just trying to think, what's Susan going to ask me? What can I prepare beforehand?
I would have told you.
I know. Fiction, I really loved Madeline Miller's Circe.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was a lovely look at the Greek myth, and I think she was fantastic. I also didn't get a chance to interview her because she's a big deal.
Yeah.
But Lauren Groff's Florida, the story collection Intertwined that I really enjoyed. And one that I read from last year that I should have gotten around to finishing beforehand, I interviewed her last year as well, was Carmen Maria Machado's Her Body and Other Stories.
I love that book.
It's so good.
I know. I wish we could get her to come here. Let's work on
that.
We'll both interview her. Let's try it.
It's great. I keep on coming back to that story, especially Heinous, which is more like a novella than anything. And these little vignettes that are both disturbing and wonderful and hilarious. And I think about that one a lot.
It's so amazing when a voice arrives and sticks in your head that way, you know, that you just, you're always going to think of that sound when you hear that book title. I mean, that story title, you know?
Exactly. And it's like, if for certain lines in there that are almost throwaway, I'll look at it and be like, that's brilliant. I'm so angry that's there and I couldn't think of it. And just how did she do that? You know, like, it's so astounding.
Is there anybody you'd like to interview that you haven't?
There's a wish list. I am a big fan of pop culture criticism. And one of the things I think I also bring to the show are trying to reframe the term writer in a way, bringing comedians on sometimes, bringing journalists, historians, all these different kind of variations of things. You maybe don't have a book, but are working in that vein. There is a TV and film critic that I love named Todd Vanderwerf, who writes for Vox.com as a movie and culture critic and wrote for the AV Club before. And he was foundational in my understanding of both TV and movies and the way that narrative functions. And I would love to have a conversation with him. He has his own podcast where he interviews interesting people. So I would love to get him on the other side of that as well.
All right, Todd, if you're listening.
Right, please.
Well, this has been such an interesting year with the Tricentennial books. It's been so overwhelming in so many ways. I think one of my favorites from the past year was Nathaniel Rich's King Zeno. Did you like that one too?
I wholeheartedly agree. That was one of those books, and I mentioned it to him when I was talking with him, that I read the first page and I immediately stopped and went back and reread the first page because I had that moment when you're reading a good book and said, like, oh, I'm in reading mode now, and I feel this. Let's start from the beginning because I'm there, and everything clicked, and I'm about this, and I love that.
I have never been down in the mud with the writer the way I was with that. Really, it just utterly captivated me, and I think it was such a risky subject to undertake at such length, and he did it all so beautifully.
Yeah, he's great at kind of those scaffolding for a large project like that and making it work, because it's a tightrope for people that are trying to engage with subjects like that and these variety of characters in a historical setting that people get almost violently possessive of the city in which they live in. And I know that's the first book that he's written explicitly about New Orleans.
Right.
And so I know he took great care and really perceived the ethics of writing about a place that he's not from initially.
You've done this for a long time. You've done this for 6 years now. So how are you feeling about our scene? I mean, you know, how it's moving through. I think it's just getting better all the time, but people say I'm Pollyanna. So, you know.
I think there are obviously problems, as within any portion of culture or society. And I think that's more localized and maybe a little bit, you have to be more insider baseball to hear about some of those things. Mm-hmm. I do think overall it is a rising tide and there are a number of things that are going really well and people are working towards fostering this community.
Well, who are some of the writers who've really informed your perceptions of the city? I mean, for me, I think the great one has been Richard Campanella. I remember once he told me you can read a city just the way you read a book. Mm. And he sort of taught me how to do that in a way, which has been very helpful. Are there any writers who kind of serve that function for you?
Richard Campanella would be one.
For everybody, isn't it true?
He's foundational in a lot of sense for understanding not only the geography of the city, obviously, but how that interacts with social and cultural and identity issues. I think the book that I recommend most to people, and it was released around the time, about a year after I first moved here, was Unfathomable City.
Yeah.
Kind of approaching the city in these disparate and fractional parts and trying to explain something, but not necessarily talking about it, but talking around it, which I think is a good way of approaching New Orleans. You'll never, quote unquote, get it, but you'll get aspects of it.
Right.
And I think that book does an incredible job of naming those aspects, both past, present, and our best and worst future prospects as well.
Well, we have our work cut out for us.
We do.
There will never run out of books. I mean, we've been talking with David Benedetto, who's the Assistant Program Director and Marketing Director at WRBH Radio for the Blind and Print Impaired and host of the Writers Forum. David, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Susan.
It's a great pleasure to welcome photojournalist J.T. Blatty to The Reading Life. Her gorgeous new book, Fishtown, Down the Road to Louisiana's Vanishing Fishing Communities, is a beauty, with eloquent and elegant images that show us what we are losing as a result of the environmental catastrophe that's taking place in South Louisiana. J.T., welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you're a New Orleans native.
I guess you could say that. I was born here, taken away for many years, and then came back for high school, went away again, and then came back again.
And then you moved back in 2010 after a military career.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that part of your life.
It's a pretty big part of my life.
It is.
So I went to the United States Military Academy at West Point. I was recruited to play tennis and 1996 and graduated in 2000, was stationed in Fort Stewart, Georgia, which is right outside of Savannah. So I spent about 10 years of my life there, even though I was in the active duty for 6 years. I stayed for another 4 years after because I just love that area so much.
Oh, nice. And then you were with the first troops to be deployed to Afghanistan after 9/11.
Yes, I was in a combat heavy engineer unit. I don't think I realized at the time when I chose to be a combat engineer that they were the first in on a deployment in combat, but I learned really quick. But yeah, we went a couple months after 9/11 to Kandahar.
And then again, you were deployed during Operation Iraqi Freedom as well,
yes,
right?
Yes, we got back from Afghanistan and probably 4 or 5 months later, we were on our way to Iraq.
So does your interest in photography come at all from that time of your life?
I was definitely always taking pictures.
Were you?
Disposable cameras most of the time because that's what I had with me, or I had a old camera that my mom gave me and I would actually send rolls of film home to have them developed, so I didn't actually get to see the pictures till I got home.
Oh no, what a,
it was
what
okay.
A long wait.
It was really for them.
Yeah, of course. Now this is a book that took a lot of work. It represents 5 years of work in South Louisiana from 2012 to 2017. And you said that it really began as a search to know more about your grandfather.
Yes. When I moved back, I always like to explore the back roads of any place where I am. And I knew that my grandfather had died or drowned in one of the fishing communities or in one of the fish towns in near Shell Beach or Wycloski. And that's about all I knew. And no one really knew any details of it except that he used to love to go fishing. And he often would take his boat down there to be by himself and be on the water. And one day he didn't come home. It was kind of a painful memory for my mom and my grandma to talk about. So they didn't have much to offer. So I went down there. And I guess you could say it was kind of my pickup line to get to know these guys. I would say, hey, you know, do you guys remember a pilot that drowned down here back in the 70s? And sometimes the responses were, I think one of my favorite ones was, you know, we found a lot of bodies here over the years.
Oh, that's the mystery of the swamp, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess you could say that, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So how did you gain their confidence? By spending time, by going out on the boats with them? You know, this is a kind of vanishing way of life that we're all so intrigued by and so many of us cherish on behalf of these people. This is a family affair that you're, you know, recounting in these photographs and words.
I would say that just the repeated visits, sometimes some of them were a little rough around the edges at first, but honestly, for the most part, I feel like all of them were really open with me, especially when I would come more than once, because I don't think there was one person in that book that only saw me one time.
Right.
And there was a decision when I had to make where I needed to decide if I wanted to expand into more parishes and just cover more of Louisiana's coast. And I just decided, for me, it's more important in real documentary work to just stay with these people and get them as they're moving through changes in their lives. And honestly, I just got along with them. Like, it almost is something I realized later. It was kind of reminded me of being on a deployment. You're just out there with the guys and gals sometimes, but you're just out there with the guys. You don't have any cell phone reception. You're just on a boat or on a dock. And the only person you can communicate with is the person who's right next to you, which just makes people closer. So it was just a lot of time spent
So tell us a little bit about the gentleman in the Tilton Hilton, for example.
The Tilton Hilton Crooked Lodge, Al Blackbird.
Yes.
I would say he was the first person I met, and I didn't find him necessarily. I was down there looking for a bathroom, or I was driving back from the far end point at where the Hurricane Katrina Memorial is, and I really needed a restroom, and there's really not a pit stop down there. But then I saw this lodge, and it just looked like it could be a convenience store of sorts, uh-huh. So I kind of slowed down and rolled my window down, and he was like standing out there, "Hey, come on in." So I pulled in. I'm like, "Is this bathroom?" He's like, "No, but you can use mine."
Aw.
And I went home that day with a cooler of fresh filleted redfish that he'd just come off the boat with. So that was a pretty cool thing.
Cajun hospitality.
And some moonshine daiquiri. I don't know if that's allowed to be on the air, but I tried
Sounds
it for my
good,
first
though.
Time. Yeah.
So tell us about some of the other families, because they are, you know, fathers and daughters, fathers and sons, mothers and sons. It's
yeah.
just a really complex tapestry.
I think the most time I've spent has been with the Robbins family and Charles Robin IV, Charles Robin III. Starting with Charles Robin III, who actually is at Jazz Fest every year in the Folklife mm-hmm. tent. He always was very open and candid about telling me all kinds of stories. But as the years progressed, I think that one thing that has been recurring that I see with them is they kind of discourage their kids, actually. Like Charles Robin IV says that he doesn't want his kids to be fishermen, unfortunately, because it's kind of a dying industry, but they all want to. Like,
yeah.
his little kid is like, "I want to be like my dad. I want to fish." So it's...
And they want to be with their dad.
Yes, That's and a lot of them thing. Grew up on boats. Like, Charles Robin IV says that he was on a boat since he was a kid. First, he was peeling the shrimp, and mm-hmm. it is always a family affair. Lisa Robin, Charles Robin III's wife, is... She's the first mate now, but she's she's there with him. You know, they're all working together on the boat. It is a family affair.
Well, did you feel connected to it once you were there? I mean, did this make you feel that connection to your grandfather?
In a way, because one thing that I learned about my grandfather was that he was a really good photographer, or that he was always taking pictures. And that's what kind of inspired me to go down there, because my mom or my aunt, maybe, they gave me like just a box of all these black and white pictures. He was just always taking pictures with his Polaroid. And a lot of them were down there in the bayous fishing. That's kind of, I guess, the part of me that I could connect with wasn't just actually the photography, but just being at this place of peace down there.
Right.
I think, because it was his escape.
Well, so many of the pictures, I mean, there are lots of people in these pictures, and they are such wonderful portraits. But you show the aerial views.
Yeah, that's
Which
a funny story.
Must have been fun to do.
Yeah, that was a... So I don't know if you knew, but I did this project all entirely in film with an old school,
yeah,
like Zenzibrotica camera, medium format film, and didn't have a light meter. I knew I needed to get aerials to really show the
perilous nature of the
yes,
place. Yes, yeah.
And just how it's just completely surrounded by water. Like, there was no way to really show it without doing it from above. I met a photographer through the New Orleans Photo Alliance at a festival, and she's actually an aerial photographer, and she has her own plane. And I just reached out and asked her to help me once, so she took me for a ride in her little plane out of the lakefront arena, and then I was out the window shooting these photographs, and right in the middle of it, the little optical lens flew off.
Ah,
and I couldn't see anything.
Oh,
so
no.
I was just like, it was just a big blur. So I was just like, I could kind of see the frame. I was like, I really hope these work, you know.
And they worked.
They worked. It was kind of like a, you only get one try.
Was that your first experience in a small plane photographing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
out
wow.
a window. Out oh, of a wow. window, yes.
Oh, but it's so much fun.
It was really fun. It was really fun. I wanted to do it again, but it never worked out.
But then you also show the built environment. You show the ravages of industry. You show the marinas. That must have been important to you.
It's all iconic. It doesn't just show the changing landscape. Even though some of it seems devastating, it also at the same time shows a familiar place to a lot of New Orleans families. For example,
right.
like the Wycloski gas plant, you know, when you go down that highway, you know, some of us see it as a bad thing, but some of us just see it as a memory or just a place that they're familiar with. And a lot of these places also are already gone. And that's a part of why I photograph these landscapes, is that I think I can name two or three businesses already that are gone since I photographed them. And even though the gas plant's gone. Mm-hmm. The little discount store is already gone. It's kind of sad. It's just about our time before. I mean, some of the people are already gone, unfortunately. Oh, so, yeah.
So did you feel a sense of real urgency as you were doing this? You did take 5 years.
I don't know if it was urgency, but really just wanting to paint a full picture and get some of the changes over time. And you can't just go into something and capture a person's like spirit the first time you take their portrait, or you have to become a part of them and be a part of their family. And it's a hard thing for me because it really becomes that for me. I can't just keep it professional. They're my friends.
Some of these photographs are so dreamy. The ones on the boat and the water, those blues, those rapturous blues, you know. So what kind of adventures did you have with these folks?
On the boats?
Yeah.
It was really just working with them, trying to stay out of their way. Sometimes, like when I was on the boat with Rocky, he's the cat fisherman and he's also a crabber out of Manchac. And there was not a lot of room for both of us, but I think that was one of the most peaceful experiences because it was just so quiet watching him work, very yeah. meditative. And even with the crabbers, it's one after the other, you know, pulling each trap. It is meditative. It's repeated actions. With the shrimpers, it's fun to get in there and work with them. You can get in there and help them once they put the shrimp on the sorting table and, you know, weeding out all the other things that yeah. are not supposed to be in there.
And those amazing nets. I love those.
Oh, I
boats.
Love it.
Aren't they beautiful?
The nets. Yes, I love the nets. Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts.
So how did you know you were ready? You were ready to put the book together.
I think that it's never finished, but I knew that it would never come out if I didn't just stop, because I will still go down there and shoot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's never over.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Let's hope it's never over.
Yeah.
The thing that's so interesting as a viewer of these photographs in a book is that there's so many different qualities to these photographs. Some of them are so dreamy and gorgeous, and some of them are such moving portraits. And the little bits of conversation we hear from these people make us love them. We grow to have such affection for them. And then some of them are kind of stark portraits of landscapes. You know, it's an interesting variety of things to look at, no matter what kind of photography you like.
Thank you. Don't know if I really thought about that, but
well,
it's interesting to hear that from, you know, perspectives from the outside.
Well, it's probably funny to think of it as a book in some ways, you
yeah.
know what I mean? Because you're thinking of it all as all these images, but the experience of this book is actually very moving. We've been talking with J.T. Blatty, whose beautiful new book is Fishtown, Down the Road to Louisiana's Vanishing Fishing Communities. J.T., thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Paul Greenberg discusses and signs the Omega Principle, seafood and the quest for a long life and healthier planet. Thursday, December 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. The New Orleans Museum of Art and the Frick Collection host a 2-day symposium January 11th through 12th, 2019, in conjunction with the Orleans Collection, an exhibit dedicated to the collecting and collection of Philippe II, Duke of Orleans, who lived from 1674 to 1723. That exhibit is on view at NOMA through January 27th. For the complete schedule for the symposium and to register, check out noma.org. In Baton Rouge, Lanny Sarum signs Handbook for Mortals, Saturday, December 29th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Barnes & Noble, Perkins Row. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.